All right, good evening, everyone. We're just gonna wait another 30 seconds here and then we're gonna start. All right, so it is 8:15, so we will make a start. Welcome everybody to another episode of The Shmooze. We are on Zoom and on Facebook, so welcome everyone who's watching. And as we always say, if you have a question or a comment or you want to argue with us, please feel free to contribute to the conversation, to the discussion. So the topic of tonight is titled, Should a Rabbi Be a Populist? And this is going to be a more of a personal discussion with my father, who is a rabbi for many, many years, and has definitely had to make some tough decisions, speak up about certain things, perhaps not so popular. Of course, a rabbi does want to be popular. So, there's a certain balance there, and that's what we're going to discuss tonight, the sort of the struggle that a rabbi has between being liked by people and standing up for ideals, standing up for what's true, which can sometimes not be so popular. So let's get right into it. Let's start with the question, is it actually important for a rabbi to be popular? Is that even a goal? Like when you became a rabbi, when you give classes, when you teach people, do you have a goal to walk out that people should like you? I mean, you're quite a likable guy, but I'm just, sort of naturally, but just sort of wondering if that's an objective of yours.
It's because you said that, otherwise you wouldn't be allowed, invited for Shabbos anymore to my house, something like that. Right. So good to be with everyone again, another session. Is it important to be a rabbi to be popular? No, I don't think so. Just a rabbi is not popular, might lose his job, that's all. Is it important as a value in itself? I don't think so. No, what I really want to say is the following, that it's not a rabbi's goal to be popular. The rabbi's goal is to lead. And this is true with all positions of leadership, is to lead and to care. Now, leading, good leadership, I think brings a good name, good... caring makes people like you, but it's really about leading and caring and bringing people closer to Hashem. Let me just say 2 points in that. First of all, why don't you ask a wider question? Is it important for anyone to be popular? So, right? So there's two things about that. Number one, the Pirkei Avot tells us the following, that the proper conduct of a person is to do something that is good for himself. In other words, it's beneficial for himself, spiritually speaking, but also beneficial to others. In other words, we have a moral responsibility to behave in a way which attracts other people to good things. So we have an obligation to actually make morality and make our way of life, if we're living that way of life, hopefully, to make it attractive, right? So in that sense, I guess the answer is yes. In other words, someone who's a spiritual leader needs to attract people. So it needs to be an example that people should say, well, I like that, I respect that, and I'm drawn to that, right? But I don't think that's the fundamental goal. It needs to be there, and it's important for the mission, overall mission. But I'm not sure that's the goal is to lead and to stand up for what's right, which is maybe we'll discuss this soon, but which could be sometimes not so popular. But yes, popularity is important, but it's not the goal. It's not the essential goal of being a spiritual leader.
I guess the question can be said differently. Is obviously the goal is not that you should be popular, but the question is you teach things, right? You stand for something. Is the goal that what you stand for should be made popular?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But it's what you stand for, not what you decide to stand for, because that's what people want. In other words, it's what you really stand for, your real values. Because we have a moral obligation. It says in the Talmud that ve'ahavtat Hashem elokecha, that you should love Hashem your God, which means that the name of God should be beloved through you. That's part of sanctifying Hashem's name. Especially when a person is in a position of any sort of spiritual leadership and stands for something that is spiritual and godly, has an obligation to make sure that that thing is attracts people to it. So that's right, not to the person, but to the values that the person stands for.
Mm.
And that, by the way, has huge consequences, a huge difference. Because if my goal is to be popular, and I think you said it very well, I think then I will just do whatever makes people like me. If the goal is to make what I stand for popular, then I will stick with what I stand for without necessarily compromising on it. But I will try to make sure that what I'm standing for, what I teach, is made popular, is likable, is attracting people.
Mm. So I guess we'll get into a little bit soon, sort of the conflict that you go through, sort of on a personal level, how to reconcile both things, how sometimes standing up for the truth is not popular. But before I get to sort of the same type of question, but I think it's a relevant question, because I think this is spoken about a lot. When it comes to, you know, people speak about Jewish continuity and sort of bringing Judaism to the masses. And I guess if you can answer this both on a principle level and on a personal level, how you feel about this, do numbers matter? Like when we make an event, if you're giving a shiur, if you're teaching Torah, if you're whatever it is, if we're making a kayemet event for young adults, whatever the sort of style of event is, do numbers matter? Like, does it matter if 20 people show up, if one person shows up, if 300 people show up? Does that actually make a difference? Is that important? Should it be a goal?
That's a great question.
Numbers say everything.
No, so I think the answer is like this. Let's be practical. Of course, numbers matter to a certain degree, right? They matter for a number of reasons. First of all, without numbers, you don't have viability. I mean, can you imagine on a very, very simple level that I went fundraising for Bin and I said, you know, we have great programs. We have 17 programs each week, and each one attracts one or two people. You know, I don't, but we have a whole team of teachers, and it's like a large budget and a big salary. I don't think it's going to work, right? It just doesn't add up. People will invest in something which can attract more people. Second of all, there's obviously a problem if it's not attracting certain numbers. It's obviously a problem. And also, your goal is to, if you really believe in what you stand for, and you're going to affect one person, obviously you want to affect more people, right? Avraham Avinu taught monotheism. He just didn't stop when he impacted one person. He drew a multitude and he created a movement. So on that level, yes, of course numbers matter. But I think the mistake sometimes people make is that numbers guide everything. In other words, what defines the success is numbers, and that's a very big mistake. Because sometimes it's important to strengthen certain things and to create certain streams of learning or certain events or certain experiences, which maybe only attract a few people, but they're important things, and it's important to be highlighted, and it's important to strengthen those few people that might be attracted to it. So numbers are important, but numbers shouldn't define success and shouldn't be the only guiding principle to what we do and what we experience. I'll just tell you a little beautiful story, since you mentioned numbers, which just came to my mind. Someone once wrote into the Lubavitcher Rebbe that they gave a speech. Well, they were supposed to give a speech, a big shiur, about family purity by going to.
It was about Rabbi Chaim Gutnick, if I'm not mistaken.
Possibly.
Yeah.
And he wrote to the Rebbe, and he said that he was really disappointed because only one woman showed up to the thing, and he thought it was a good speech and maybe even influenced her and inspired her, but it was only one person. To which the Rebbe answered that Moshe Rabbeinu only had one mother.
Right.
So in other words, of course, you want to make something as popular as possible. But if you run an event and only attracts a few people, never undermine. You never know what can come out of that.
Mm. Sure. So I guess the question is, and this is obviously a very broad question, and you can spend some time answering this. So it is important to make the things that we stand for popular and to attract people and to attract numbers. How do you do that together with standing up for principles? Sometimes, the principles that we stand for are not popular. Torah is not necessarily the best-selling book in the 21st century. It's not the most popular way of life either. So how do we put these two things together? How do we make things attractive, but on the one hand, and on the other hand, stick to the truth, stick to the... And let me just add to the question a little bit, sort of prompting a certain direction. Do you have to say every truth? So the Torah says certain things, which I'm not going to say now. maybe you could bring some examples, which might shock some people. And if you say that at a shir, this won't come back again. It's that simple. Like, do you always have to say the full truth? Can you sort of pick and choose? Can you hide certain things? Can you gloss over certain things? How does that work?
Okay, so it's a very broad question, and it's a great question. I think it's probably the core of what we're discussing, I suppose. So let me just go back. So a number of components here. Let's go back, first of all, to what we started with. Is it important to be popular? And I think we established the following. So let's just summarize it, first of all. A spiritual leader, someone who's there in any position of leadership, whether it's a teacher, whether it's a rabbi, whether it's any spiritual leader, Robertson, whatever it might be, right? Has to stands for something. And that's something that they stand for, that they want to impart and inspire other people with, correct? So I think as we started off, the goal is not to be popular. The goal is to make what you stand for popular. Now, which means, therefore, what you stand for always has to remain what you stand for. If you stand for something, you have to believe in it, and you have to believe in it with the strength and the conviction that you're not going to really compromise on what you stand for. Now, you could package it and talk about it in a way that it's inspires other people, which first of all goes into another concept. In other words, like this: we don't have to necessarily be popular. We have to stick to our principles, and we have to make those principles popular. We have to make those principles palatable and attractive to other people, which means that first of all, we have to have a combination, I think, right? I think this is probably one of the most important things. We have to have a combination of believing in certain principles, which might not always be popular, but also being tactful. There's nothing wrong in having tact, right? Mm-hmm. Often the difference between a tactful person and a tactless person is not what they believe in. It's how they communicate it and when they communicate it, the timing, the setting, the packaging.
I think that's in everything in life. I don't think that's only in principle. I think it's
exactly.
Relationships and everything.
So yeah. I think the goal is never to compromise on what you really believe in, but at the same time, you have to be tactful, which being tactful means a number of things. First of all, you mentioned you have to say the whole truth. There's a nice little saying in Yiddish, which means you're not allowed to lie, but you don't always have to say the whole truth, right? In other words, not everything is relevant at the moment, right? When you meet someone, anyone for that matter, religious, not religious, you don't dump on them the entire 613 mitzvahs right away, right? I'll give you a simple example. I mean, there are very, very intricate laws of keeping Shabbos, for example, right? Very, very specific things, like huge things, that when you make a tea, you've got to pour the water into one cup and then into a second cup, right? If you invite someone to your house for Shabbos and you're trying to expose them to the beauty of Shabbos, and you say, let me explain to you about Shabbos, and you start talking about Shabbos, you're not going to start with how you make tea on Shabbos, because you'll probably put them off for life. I think you're completely crazy. And right? Does that mean you don't believe in it? Does that mean if it came up or if you had to make a tea in front of them, you wouldn't do it? Of course you would. You would never compromise. But it doesn't mean you have to run away going to things that you need to know. What are the parts of Torah that are easier to communicate at first? What should you start with? How do you bring people in? How do you bring people in to right? Not everything has to be said. Not everything has to be communicated right away. And those things that do have to communicate, it can be communicated softly with respect. And that goes into the next thing. I think it's really, really important, again, that we never, ever compromise on our principles. But at the same time, when we communicate those principles, it has to be done in a way where it's without judgment, right? I think very, very often people are turned away when principles are communicated in a way, these are my principles, and therefore I look down at you because I don't think you subscribe to the same principles, and therefore I'm looking down at you and you're a second-class citizen. I don't think that's right. We don't know who's higher and who's lower. That doesn't mean just because I believe in things, just because I have values, it doesn't mean that people don't subscribe to those values, at least in behavior, that they're any better than me. Maybe there's certain things that I'm not doing right, or that they're far better than me, right? So I think when people don't like to feel judged, and I've had this discussion with lots and lots of people. The main thing is when people come to you and people are around you and people connect with you and relate to you and communicate to you, they want to be accepted for who they are. They want to be not judged. It's okay to say, very often it's okay to portray who you are and what you believe in. But if it's without, so tact is a very, very important thing. How you package things is a very, very important thing. Without judging people is really, really important. But then at the end of the day, sometimes we have to be unpopular. In other words, when it comes to the crunch and there's something that we ask to do and it's against our principles. Now, I must just point out, not everything is black and white. There are sometimes, for example, that I might behave in a particular way, but there's room in halacha, there's room that Torah says, and to bring people closer, we can be more lenient. I'm not talking about those things. I'm talking about things that we really, really believe in, things that we stand up for, that sometimes we're in a very tricky situation, and sometimes we just have to be brave enough to, in the nicest way possible, to stand up for our principles, even if it's not popular. Which reminds me of a little vert saying I once heard. And in general, I mean, we can't always say what people like to hear. Sometimes we have to push people also to grow. And I heard a beautiful little saying once that the job of a rabbi is to make those who are uncomfortable feel comfortable, and to make those that feel comfortable uncomfortable.
Hmm.
It's also part of it. So that's all part of it.
So let's get into details a little. Let's get a little bit more personal. So what's an example for that? Have you ever taken an unpopular stand? Has that ever, you know, have you ever been tested with that? Because, I mean, I guess sort of to summarize what you said before, we can't lie. You know, if someone asks us, is this what the Torah says? And it is. And you know that the person's really not going to like it, and they may never talk to you again. You may say it in the nicest way possible without judgment, but you can't lie. You can't say it's not like that, right? So have you ever been asked the question, or been asked to do something that really went against your principles, and it was a test, it was difficult, and you knew that person would not be happy, and you didn't do it anyway, or you did do it, or whatever the case is?
Okay, so I want to break this up into two parts. I think it's a good question. First, I'll get to your specific question, but just to, I mean, me and you have done certain activities, for example, where we've engaged with Jews who at the moment are very, very, they're not so engaged, and they're not so knowledgeable, and they unfortunately are quite unaffiliated or not engaged with Jewish practice, right? We've tried to make events where we should have a sort of a certain type of Friday night service, whatever the case is, where you want to sort of bring them in, correct?
Yeah.
And sometimes we have to make difficult requests because we've thought a lot about it. We always think and we always make sure that what we're doing might be a little bit different to normal shul service, but it's always according to halachic practice and Allah dictates. And sometimes the things that we ask people to do is hard, and it'll be easier, and it'll be much, maybe we get more numbers if we didn't do that. Like if we said we get done with Adam Mechitza, for example, I mean, just to give you an example, right? We haven't done that because you have to, what you believe in, you believe in. If it's not, you know, and numbers aren't your problem. I mean, if that's going to minimize the numbers, we are soldiers of Hashem, and therefore, you know, we try to be as tactful and as politically correct as possible, and diplomatic as possible. That's what I'm trying to say. But at the end of the day, what we need to stick to. But in terms of you asking me, have I ever been in a position? So I'll give you two examples. it's been a political day, so maybe it's okay to go into these kind of things, right? I'm just kidding. We'll talk about politics soon. But so I was asked. And again, I need to say this slowly, and those who are on Facebook or Zoom, listen to this carefully, because it wasn't such a popular thing to say. I was asked to be part of a series on basic Jewish knowledge, right? Which would give me exposure to people who I don't reach normally, which would be quite an opportunity. And I was asked to do that together with But I, you know, it was a series, and I would give one or two sessions, and a member of the Reformed clergy would give some of the others, right? And I had to say no. But it was someone who asked me to do it, who I knew would not understand what I'm about. And she's a person that was, you know, involved in Bina and come to Bina stuff, but I knew this would be something very hard for her to understand, right? So I said, look, and again, I think that's why I needed to put into practice all the things we've been talking about. I said, can we have a discussion about this? So I said, listen, let me try and explain to you. I'm going to actually say no, I'm going to decline, but let me explain it to you. And I said, I want you to understand that I have nothing against the people, right? And also I said, I'm a very inclusive person when it comes to Orthodoxy. I work together with all kinds of different forms of Orthodox rabbis, modern Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox, this type, that stripe, Ashkenazis, whatever the case is, right? But I said, I am a person of values and I'm a person of principles. And I believe in a set of very, very fundamental principles. I don't say that it has to be implemented the way I implement it necessarily, but those fundamental principles are the 13 attributes of faith, right? As we know, the Yud Gimel Ikrim, the 13 attributes of the Rambam's faith. And I said, I have no problem if there was an opportunity to sit at the table by a wedding with the Reformed person or even a Reformed rabbi, I have no problem. I'd be very, very, I'd love to sit with him, say l'chaim with him, and have a good time with him. He's a human being, he's a Jew, is it's all good, I said. But I'm not prepared, and I had to be very honest with it, and I said, I don't judge anyone, I'm with the greatest of respect. It took me like 45 minutes to actually get this out, right? I have to be honest. I said, look, Reform Judaism is a philosophy which I'm adamantly against. It goes against the principles of Orthodox Judaism. It goes against the principles of Torah, the eternity of Torah from Sinai. And it's not something that I'd be prepared to give any support to. And therefore, sharing a platform with a Reform clergy means that I'm giving it respect as another form of Judaism. I cannot do that. I'm tempted to do that because I knew it would open me up to people that I wouldn't have otherwise a connection to. It was very, very tempting, but I had to kind of say, thank you, but no thank you. But I really, I mean, not always people, what you know, not always what you want to work works well. This did, thank God. She said to me, I don't really understand. I understand what you're saying. It's hard for me to hear. I don't really get it. But, and then I didn't see her for a few weeks and I thought, oops, okay. But then, no, we've met since and she's come to Shurim and I don't know if you're listening to that, maybe on Facebook, but if you are, you know, you are, and I have tremendous respect for you. But we're still friends, and you can disagree, and that's fine. I think that's part of the you know, if people can have different values and believe in different things and have mutual respect, that's fantastic. But it was an example of something where I know that this is for some people this is very, very hard, and people now. I don't emphasize it. I don't go around, you know, publicizing. I don't provoke anyone. I don't make a big deal out of this because that's unnecessary. When push comes to shove, I have my principles. I will not share a platform with the Reform Rabbi because I do not, nothing against the people, but the philosophy is something which is directly opposed to what we believe in. And I will not give that any respect. I cannot give any support, I should say, is the word, right? The other thing I'll mention once we're getting already a little bit controversial, this was a very, very difficult one. And again, I tried to do it the greatest way. This wasn't only me. It was me and a few other rabbis. A lot of people would remember that a couple of years ago, there was a big, big to-do about who is a Jew in terms of conversion and so on and so forth. And a certain Jewish day school wouldn't accept someone that wasn't halachically Jewish. And I got into big trouble and huge media coverage. And I just thought, we have to stand up for what's right. We have to give them the support. We are the people. But if we don't say something nicely, again, it's not something I broadcast, not something I, you know, but it was the time to stand up and in the most respectful way by making it, understanding the pain of the people that went through that, understanding the problem, understanding the challenge. We, a couple of us did make a statement. I got into trouble for it a little bit. I did damage control on the trouble I got into, but I don't regret it because I think it was an important stand to make. I mean, there were some misunderstandings and I ironed them out and so on and so forth. But yes, sometimes you have to do that. And sometimes little things, you know, little things that, whatever it is, if it's a matter in halacha that you have to stand up for, it might be even an individual thing. You know, sometimes people, you know, they say a joke that even when people that, you know, keep halacha and so on, that they devise a new computer program that you put in a halachic question into your computer and they don't tell you the answer, they tell you which rabbi to ask this question to, right? And you know, sometimes people, you see, sometimes people are very, very quick to put very lenient rulings on Facebook. It makes them very, very popular. Obviously, you have to deal with everyone. The idea is not to be over strict. There's room in halacha to be lenient. But sometimes people ask questions and you have to tell the truth. This is the halacha. And they might not like you and they might be upset with you and say, but I heard on Facebook and I heard on Google. No, this is what it is. I'm sorry. But it needs to be done with respect and with love and with care.
That's great. Let's go to the flip side for a moment. So sometimes we have to stand up for what's right, and even if it's not popular. But sometimes, you know, people have certain convictions, and sometimes we go too extreme. You know, everyone makes mistakes in life. Has there ever been a time where you made a mistake, where you went too far, where you sort of said something perhaps you shouldn't have said, and it was too extreme, or you sort of in retrospect you should have done a little bit differently? Has that ever happened?
So in terms of your question, have you ever made mistakes? The answer is absolutely yes. Of course, we all make mistakes. I don't know if I'm going to go into too much detail, but yes, we all make mistakes, and rabbis definitely make mistakes. I pray, I suppose, to Hashem every day that if I do make a mistake, which I'm sure I will continue to make, that I should do two things. I should at least recognize that it was a mistake. I should learn from that mistake. And if in the process of the mistake, I hurt someone or offended someone, I should be able to apologize. Right? And that's not, all those things are not easy, because most of us don't like to admit our own mistakes. And that's not an easy thing. But yes, there's been times where I think, you know, as, you know, part of the combination of what we do, right? I do, you do, we all do, is, as I said before, we make the uncomfortable comfortable and the comfortable uncomfortable. And part of that is to push. In other words, I'm just a rabbi, or any leader for that matter, is not just a person for everyone to like and to make them feel good with themselves, right? Yeah, of course, it's to lift up people to make them feel good, but it's also to inspire and to push. Our job is to ask people to grow and to push people to grow, right? And which means sometimes we have to give a little push, right? So yes, so there's been times where push has been very successful. There's also been times where I try to push something and realize afterwards that I was pushing too hard. In other words, not that I thought what I believed in isn't right, but I thought I was premature. I was pushing too hard too early. So yes.
So you said it's difficult to admit your mistakes. How do you realize that you made a mistake? Do you when people point out that you've done something wrong? If someone says, you know, I think you've, do you, is that a struggle for you to accept that? Is that sort of? It's going a little personal here.
Huh? Well, okay. So I don't think that's a rabbi question. I don't think that's a leader. I think that's a personal growth question for every human being. So one of the lucky things I do is that I give.
In other words, let me just add to the question for a little bit. In other words, if there's a lot of people saying you did something wrong, it could be you did something wrong, and it could be they're all wrong. So in other words, how do you sort of in that itself, how do you decide that you are right or you're wrong? Like on what basis?
So. Okay, so let me backtrack a second. First of all, it's not always wrong and right. It's also wrong for that person or right for that person. Mm. You know, interestingly enough, when Moshe Rabbeinu, right, the ultimate leader, was coming to the end of his life, he asked Hashem. He came to Hashem and he says, "Listen, I'm not leaving these people like a sheep without a flock. A flock without a shepherd." And he spoke to Hashem very strongly, so to speak. The Chumash tells us to help him appoint a new leader. Right, and he said, "I want to. Can Hashem please appoint my successor, Ish Asher Ruach Bo, a person who will have the spirit, the Ruach." Right. Now, without going into all the details, the nuances of the verse, but Rashi tells us that what Moshe Rabbeinu was referring to, he asked Hashem to appoint someone that can address and cater for the Ruach, for the spirit, for the thinking, for the perspective of each individual. Right, and at the same time, he asked him to appoint a man, and the term is when he makes the same man, but the word ish is a reference to strength, because Any leader has to have a combination of reading the audience, reading the person, reading the people, knowing where they're up to, what they're thinking, what they're feeling, how they're taking it, how they're absorbing what you take, what you're telling them. And at the same time, to be a little bit above in terms of being strong about the convictions that you have and not pandering to everyone. So it's not a matter of, I mean, it's like that. If you run a school, you run an organization, anything, right? You need to, I mean, no, it's not like running a business. Running a business is all about the customer. So you got to know what's going to sell the product. In religious organizations or leadership positions, it's about a combination, knowing what is going to be attractive to people, but also what's the product I want people to want.
Mm.
Right? Now, I've forgotten your question. Yes.
How do you tell if you made a mistake? If they're wrong or you're wrong?
So one of the lucky things I do is in Binaz, you know, we give a lot of personal growth shiurim, right? I always tell the people that I give these classes to that I gain more than they do, which is, by the way, absolutely true. And it also comes from what the Gemara says, that you learn more from your students, but particularly in the area of personal growth. Because first of all, sometimes I've got people who are close to me or relatives, including my own mother, who listens to them, and she always asks me, do you practice what you preach? Right? So that's always a good reminder. No, but on a serious note, when you talk about these things, it gives you a lot of room to think about them. I think one of the most important things is to think, to always look back, to review, right? And reviewing in terms of criticism means that you always have to, you know, there's a whole wealth of stuff of how to embrace criticism. No one likes criticism, and part of the reason why we don't like criticism is because when people criticize us, we take it personally, you know, like, because I'm defined. If I made a mistake, that means I'm bad, or right? Mm. So the first thing is to know that, you know, you're not defined by the mistakes you make, and we should embrace criticism, but you need to do what I call a criticism autopsy. In other words, you need to take the criticism and listen to it, and then decide, like, honestly decide, be as objective and honest as you can. Maybe, let me put myself in that person's shoes, maybe I made a mistake. Maybe I didn't. If I didn't, you know, you go through, sometimes you need to discuss it with someone else, sometimes you need to go to someone else. And you need to decide, but decide honestly. Made a mistake, you should change. And it's a strength. It's a strength to admit you made a mistake. It's a strength to apologize. And it's a strength to say, you know, I need to do it differently from now on. Sometimes you have to say, no, I have thought about it and I've spoken about it. And no, I've come to the conclusion. I need to explain it better or talk about it better. But this is my position and I'm not budging. But generally speaking, if it's a lot of people telling the same thing, normally, if everyone tells you making a mistake,
well, is that true? Just to push back a little bit, is that true? Do you go by the majority? You know, our values are the minority; they're not the majority. So,
yeah, no. So normally, I think when everyone is upset with you, it's normally a matter of it's not a matter that they, yeah. I mean, the values we teach. I mean, Abraham Avinu
was the only one who held his values. Now,
before a whole generation, but at the same time, he attracted a lot of people, right? Mm. But if no one's attracted to what you're teaching, either you're making a mistake or you're not teaching it right. So, or you're not communicating right. So somewhere along the line, you need to pick up on that, right?
Right.
There's a limit to how much a person can say, well, you know, I'm right and let the whole world jump in the lake. I mean, it's not working. So if it's not working, there's a reason why it's not working.
And I think just sort of to add to what you just said, you always say this a lot, and it's something which I've learned from you, and I think it's a tremendous lesson. You always have to know where something is coming from. Like sometimes, like we all have an ego, and sometimes when we get upset about things or we sort of take a stand on things, it's not coming from our values; it's coming from our ego. So, and you always say this a lot, but as long as you know where it's coming from, you have a chance. Like if you understand that it's, you know, if you got very excited over something and then you stood up for something and it was only because of your ego, and at least then afterwards, after you've calmed down, you can say, okay, I did that wrong. But if you think that everything is you think that everything is coming from your values, then okay, so I'm always right. You know, it's always, I'm such a perfect person. I think it's, you always said, it's always very important to know where it's coming from.
Right, yeah, that's 100% right. So it's okay sometimes to feel upset with someone or to feel hurt by what someone said or criticize you, et cetera, but then you have to stop and think, where's this coming from? Or if I disagree with that person, where? Because we all have two parts to us. We have what's called the godly soul and the animal soul. And we all have an ego, and that's okay. Except for the select few great tzaddikim of the world that are completely selfless, the rest of us all have an ego. We have to work on it. And therefore, we need, yeah, you're right. We need to reflect, where is this coming from? Maybe, and it's okay if I'm not able to completely work on my ego right now, that's also okay. It's just, I need to know that it's from the ego. In other words, don't turn everything into a religious war. Because, yeah, maybe I'm not prepared to even change my view now, but at least I'm not going to fight for it because I know where it's coming from. And slowly, slowly, I can work on, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm. So, how do you keep yourself grounded in what's important? You know, we deal with a lot of different people, a lot of different situations. What keeps you personally grounded in sort of in your values, to sort of stick to your values? And let me just add a few other questions to that, and sort of you can expand on all of it. Have any of your values changed over time? Like, you know, as did you once upon a time think something was right and now you think it's wrong, or you thought it was wrong, now it's right? Have you become more extreme in your values, less extreme?
My extreme.
But what keeps, yeah. And I guess included is in that question is what does keep you sort of on your values? If anyone has any questions, please feel free to add and ask.
So I think that's a general question. Nothing to do with a rabbi or a leader. It's a good question. Everyone, how does anyone stay on the right track, right?
Well, I think especially for people like you, that you deal with so many different types of people and so many different types of programs and trying to do so many different types of things, it's easy to lose.
Yeah, I guess tying into the beginning of the discussion, how do you stay true to what you believe in, and how do you not sort of lose the plot halfway, which is... You know, the Pirkei Avot tells us, "Al tamim ba'atzchad yom matach." A person should never believe in themselves and trust themselves until the day they die. Right. Yeah. So I think that's the first thing. The first thing is for a person to be aware that you can always change. You can always lose the plot. You can always be tempted. You can be tempted because, you know, someone has influence or power or wealth, whatever the case is, to bend your values. You can be influenced by the temptation of popularity. You can be influenced by so many things, and none of us are above being vulnerable. We all are prone to that. We all can, at any time in our life, lose the plot very, very simply, very, very quickly. So knowing that is already good. And I think, how do you ground it? So I think there's a few things that everyone has to do, particularly people in leadership positions. First of all, I think it's really important that people spend time on self-education, right? Because people, you know, and I've told this to a lot of people, I've been asked to speak to, you know, younger rabbis sometimes, or younger, you know, younger shluchim around the world and so on and so forth. I always say to them, even if your job is giving shiurim, you always have to ask yourself the question, how much do you learn yourself? And I define the word learning yourself. Learning yourself means learning something that won't be good for a shiur, right? Learning something that's just totally a different topic, that's not good for any lesson. Eventually you'll use it for a lesson because everything is relevant, but in other words, are you spending time on your own personal growth? And that's really important. Your own personal davening, your own personal Torah learning, your own personal whatever it is, right? I mean, taking care of yourself also, sharpening the saw. Stephen Covey likes to say you have to sometimes just, you know, not get burnt out. But in a spiritual sense, are you spending time revisiting what you believe in? Are you spending time thinking about the things that are the foundation of what you do, right?
Yeah.
Number one. Number two, I cannot emphasize enough how important it is to fulfill what the Pirkei Avot says, asei l'charav, to have a mentor. Everyone has to have a mentor, a guide, a rabbi, a poisek, whatever the case is, right? I have a couple, meaning a person that's a mentor, some people that I ask lachi questions to. A rabbi has to have a rabbi. Every rabbi has to have a rabbi, right? So everyone has to have a spiritual guide, a spiritual mentor. So because, as the Talmud says, you are related to yourself. So therefore, you never know. Sometimes you're subjective, right? And there's been times where I've had questions and I thought to myself, you know, I think I know what to do. And I've doubted myself in a healthy way. I mean, self-doubt all the time is very bad, but you have to convince, you have to go with them. But at the end of my mind, I've thought to myself, is this just me giving in to an opportunity, or is it really the right thing? And I've consulted. And when you consult, either you get to know that it's the right thing and you feel good with that, or they point out that, no, maybe you shouldn't do it. And that's been the case a number of times. And that's very, very, very healthy. That same passage which says you should have a mentor also says you should have friends. You should have people you talk to, people that you can talk these things out to, you can discuss these things with, so that you always have other people, sort of checks and balances kind of thing, to use a modern term, which isn't working very well in some parts of the world, but you can sort of check in and you can, what do you think, bounce things off. But it's a very, very important process. Otherwise, you can become very, very affected.
And is there anything else that you personally do sort of to keep you focused on your mission, on your job, on what's really important?
So I think these are the three things that I like to try and focus on mainly.
Okay. Someone has a question. How do you deal with rage? I think that's a general question, but sort of to apply it to our discussion, I think is something that, you know, as someone who's just started out, relatively speaking, you know, when you're in this position and you deal with people can anger you. You know, it's like, I'll give you an example, right? It was sort of over the whole Tishrei, this past Tishrei was crazy, right? You know, like the amount of organization needed to happen. It's like, you know, to find a location where everyone can fit and social distancing, like you work very, very hard. And then you have that one person who comes and complains, right? And it can actually anger you. It can actually, and sometimes you can sort of lose it almost. And how do you deal with that?
So, yeah. So there's always jobs available that don't have to do with people. Like, you know, you can work on computers.
You could also become a shaykhet. You know,
shaykhet.
Of animals.
Lots of different opportunities out there. But I think, you know, if you want to deal with people and you want to hopefully make it a success, we have to learn the art of patience. What does that mean? So let's break that down a little bit. I mean, rage is something, as we know in Hebrew, it's called kas, right? It's something that we all have to deal with at some point in time, and it's a big issue. It's a human temptation. The Talmud is very, very intolerant, I should say, of the concept of rage. However, we're all human beings. So the first thing to remember is, again, you have to distinguish, as Rabbi Tversky likes to break it down. He says there's three parts. There's anger, rage, and resentment. Anger is the initial feeling of being really annoyed, right? Someone says something to you, someone does something to you, someone undermines you. So there's that feeling. That's a human being, except for great tzaddikim. Most human beings will have that feeling, and it's not controllable. You will have it, right? Rage is our choice. So it's knowing that it's okay to have that, it's normal, I'm human. Then we have to do what you said before, to think about where's that coming from, right? Rage is never a good thing. You know, I think we were having this discussion the other day about something, and we were talking about the saying of the Talmud that divrei chachamim benachas nishmoim. There's only one way. And I must say, as I get older, I learn it more and more, I think, I hope. Anyways, I'm trying. That to communicate values, to communicate things, to get on with people, calmness, to talk calmly, to talk, you know. There are many things that get us angry, not only what people do in terms of interpersonal relationships, but sometimes even you get angry by the values. You know, sometimes people try to undermine your values, you get really, really upset. And then sometimes there's people from unexpected sources who, you know, coming with new things and undermining what you're doing. And it's really easy to get really, really, really angry and upset. We need to, first of all, we're always going to make a mistake, and there will be times that we get angry. That's okay. We can always apologize, and we can always work on ourselves. We can always, you know, think back, and maybe next time I have to try harder not to get angry. But really, it's about, it's about learning about it. There's, you know, there's a famous letter of the Ramban, Nachmanides, that deals with anger. It's a letter he wrote to his son, and he asked his son to reread it every day or every week, I think, right, where he talks about the pitfalls of anger and how bad it is and so on and so forth about rage. And that's really important, to keep on revisiting that, to learn about it and to think about it, and to, it's a work in progress. I think each of us need to know we're all a work in progress. We all have to grow. We all have to improve as human beings. And we have to keep refining ourselves. And every person has their own tests. So when you deal with people, that's part of the test, you know, of having to put up with things that can be very annoying.
So have you been, sort of, you didn't touch on some of the questions I asked before. Have you become more or less extreme over time?
I thought you forget about that question. I tried.
I'm very interested in that question, actually.
I don't know what you mean. I don't know what you mean by that. You need to explain that.
Like, do you feel like when you were younger, you were more idealistic and more extreme in your values, and now you've sort of, you know, mellowed in certain things and seen as you've gotten older?
So I think, I feel like it's a confession session here tonight. This is really personal here tonight. Okay, anyways. I hope people are finding this interesting. But so it's interesting. So I don't think my fundamental values have changed, gone big or small. I think, I mean, I was born into, we spoke about this a few months ago, I think. I was born into a very good home with very strong values, and I kind of, the general values I have, and the things I believe in, and the basic belief systems that I have are from my childhood. How I've implemented them certainly has changed. How I express them has changed. And in certain things, I've gotten stronger, and in certain things, I've gotten weaker. And what I mean by that is as follows. When you talk about extreme, I don't know what you mean by that. I've gotten calmer as I've gotten older. You know, there's certain things that I was very, very, very strong about, which I still am, which I still am very strong about, but I've learned to communicate them better, and I've learned to share them better. Where maybe, and I think that's, I mean, I think that the greatness of youth is that you're very, very passionate, and losing that passion is not a good thing. It's only good if it's, you know, certain cases where the passion makes it very excitable, and we need to learn to communicate it calmer, better context, better packaging. But in certain things, I would say maybe, you know, with time, thank God I've gotten stronger, which is a good thing, I think, not a bad thing.
Hmm. So what has been your best decision as a rabbi? You know, it's always good to know your strengths and your weaknesses. We discussed the weaknesses before, or struggles, I should say, sort of what was more difficult. What's been the...
I think employing you has been a pretty good decision.
Well, time will tell.
You know, you're one of the guys that keep me in check, you know, make sure I'm grounded, make sure I'm doing the right thing. Well, I think, the best decision, on a career level, you could say, has been, I mean, I think it's been one of the best things I've done is hopefully, I mean, for myself and hopefully for others. But I'll tell you it's a little story. I mean, I don't know if it's the best decision, I'll tell you a good decision, right? And because it's just got to do what we spoke about before. It's this thing I said before about having a mentor, I mean, I always had that sort of a symbolically, but it's only a number of years ago that I actually really acted upon it properly. And I sort of, you know, I spoke to someone, I said, do you mind if I ask you things once in a while and check in with you once in a while and so on and so forth. And it's just an interesting story. There was one time a thing in Sydney that a number of years ago that I was sort of pulled to get involved in a particular thing. I'm not going to go through what it was, but it was a particular thing, a communal thing. And I thought it was very, very important, but also knew it would be controversial. But I thought it's really important. It's important for Yiddishkeit. It's important for whatever it was, right? And I thought it was, and I was convinced, you know, because sometimes you just are convinced. It's like an amazing thing. You just become, like, it was clear to me is that, you know, it was clear that I need to get involved. There's something I have to stand up for. And it's be unpopular, but it doesn't matter, et cetera, et cetera. So I started, before I actually do it, I'm going to check in with the guy that I asked questions to, right? And I spoke to him and I shared with him what it was. And it was just incredibly amazing. He asked me one small question. He says, I hear what you're saying. This thing is important. But is it your mission? Your mission in Sydney is to bring people closer to Yiddishkeit, and particularly in the context of giving shiurim and classes and learning, you educate people. Is this your mission? In other words, is this going to undermine your mission? Is it going to make your mission better or worse? And that was it. Just the whole thing flipped in 5 seconds. He saved me. Because although there are people that need to get involved in that thing, it was not me. And it would have been bad for me. It would have been bad for me. It would have been on many, many levels. And it would have undermined what I'm doing. Mm. Now, it doesn't mean that I suddenly changed my belief system. In other words, that's what you were saying before. There's certain things you believe in, but not necessarily you have to get involved in everything you believe in. Right? In other words, if I was asked a question about it, I'd have to give an honest answer. But it doesn't mean I have to get involved and be active in that particular area where it would undermine what I'm doing. But it was an example of, it just validated so much this concept that you have to have someone you check in with.
Mm. Someone has a question. How did the rabbi know he wanted to lead people?
I'm sorry, what was that?
How did rabbi know he wanted to lead people? How do you know this was your calling?
Sure, that's a very good question. So I think that's a question on a number of levels. First of all, I don't know that generally I wanted to go into some form of teaching or sharing or outreach, and that's something that I was educated from a very young age, and that's something that the Lubavitcher Rebbe was very, especially when I was a bocher, when I was a student in yeshiva in New York, it was something he would speak about a lot. And it was a particular in the 80s. It was very, very strong about that and pushing people to go out. So it was in my blood, it was part of my DNA. But how do I know the specific area? So it was a combination of, I always loved giving shurim, I always loved teaching from a very young age. And when I was in Sydney doing something else for the first few years, and then moved on to what we're doing now, like over 20 years ago, it was a need that I saw, and it was something I was passionate about. I thought there was a need for it. So with the help of a number of people and the encouragement of other people, that's what I went into. And it was fantastic. It is fantastic.
Okay. So if anyone has any other questions, please feel free to ask. But because it is, we can't just, you know, skip this altogether. There is a sort of a crazy election happening in the United States of America, where although some people want to think that someone has won, but actually no one's won yet. No one knows what's happening. It's pretty crazy. But we don't talk about politics, so we're not going to talk about politics. But I guess that itself is the question, actually. It sort of fits into the theme of what we're discussing all the time. Should a rabbi get involved in politics? And it's actually been interesting. You know, there's been certain rabbis who have gotten involved in politics, and certain rabbis just says, no, that rabbi should not get involved in politics. So it's an interesting question. What do you think?
So as you probably know, at dinner we never talk politics.
We never talk politics.
Well, sometimes Shabbos afternoon,
the rabbis never talk politics.
And we happen to have in the binah, and I think that's okay because everyone's entitled to their opinion. We happen to have people on quite opposite sides of political views.
Yeah,
which is quite fascinating, and that's great. I don't think it's a rabbi's job to talk politics. I think there's enough to do. There's enough to teach, enough to inspire, without getting involved in politics. I think it's important for everyone to know that most politics, it's not black and white. There are different views. No one's perfect. There are different sides of looking at things. I think it's okay for rabbi to have his own personal views. That's fine, but that's your personal matter. We are private people, and I'm not going to tell you who I would vote for if I was American and lived there, but I would have my view and I would do it, right? And there could be all sorts of reasons why people wouldn't do that, right? But I think it's the same thing we said before, right? I think not everything has to be said. In other words, I try my very, very best not to get involved in politics, and it's become very, in fact, I got told by someone in shul a number of years ago, months ago, that I'm probably the person who likes politics very, very much, that he's never met someone who's so apolitical. Because I'm not apolitical. I actually do have views. I just don't get involved in politics, right? But I think it's the same thing. I think that, number one, it doesn't mean that if you ask a question, you have to lie. In other words, sometimes you can ask a question, either you can say, I don't want to discuss it, or you can say, you know, what relates to your values, I think you have to say. So I'll give you an example, right? Even Israeli politics, which I think is very close to all of us, I don't talk about it in public. I don't give sermons about it. I don't live there. I don't understand half of it. I mean, it's almost impossible to understand anyways, but right? But if someone, for example, I'll give you an example, right? And I hope it's not the wrong thing to say, but I'm going to say it anyways, right? If, because I just said you don't have to say everything, but this I will say, right? Even though I don't normally even talk about this that much, but I mean, if it comes up, right? If someone wanted to do something that was political, but also went against a value system that I have, then I would speak up. So for example, I'll just give you an extreme example. Let's say someone wanted to put out some literature in the shul, for example, right? On a Shabbos, says, can I put out this pamphlet? Now, by the way, normally when people say, can I put a pamphlet if it's got words of Torah or stuff on the Parsha, I'm not really fussed from which Orthodox community it comes from. I'm okay, and it can be different views, and that's also good, right? So I'm normally very, very okay with that. But let's say I wanted to put out pamphlets which explicitly encourage Israel to give away land for peace, for example, let's say, right? I would say no. And not because it's political, not because I believe in one political view or another, because I believe that's a principle which, in my value system, it's against Torah. Right? I don't believe Israel should give away land. I think they can be doing lots of other things for peace, but they shouldn't be giving away Eretz Yisrael, because if Hashem gave us land of Israel, it belongs to us. Right? And I think that's, I have no problem being apologetic about it. Do I campaign about it? Do I go out and talk about it? No, it's not my job. I don't judge people who hold different than me, who believe in a different point of view. But I would, in other words, so that's the extent of how political we get. But in terms of general politics, Australia, Israel, or America, for that matter, I have some ideas, and I quite enjoy it. I must say, I'll be honest. I mean, I can't tell you. I didn't look at the website today.
Well, it didn't quite help you because there's no decision. So
yeah, it's quite annoying, actually. But I mean, I find it very entertaining. I find it fascinating. So I am interested in it, and I have certain views, and they nuanced views sometimes, et cetera, et cetera. But it's not my job. I don't get involved in anything.
All right, everyone. We'll have, I believe, one more installment of this for this term. We'll announce the topic throughout the week. So same place, same time next week on Wednesday. And until then, have a wonderful night and a wonderful week.
Thank you so much, everyone.